The case will be taken under advisement. We're going to go on to the second case of the day. And that case is 1137. I'm sorry.
Can I go get my other appendixes?
Sure.
I got left over here.
1137-58, Humphreys versus Milwaukee County.
Thank you.
It is. Thank God. It's funny. Thank God.
Okay. Hello, Mr. Meyer.
Good morning.
Hey.
Please, the court. My name is Jeffrey Meyer. I represent Plaintiff Shante Humphreys. The complaint in this case alleged a claim for injunctive relief and for damages for violation of the Due Process Clause in the denial of Ms. Humphreys' request for child care certification. The injunctive relief request became moot approximately 8 months after the complaint was filed, when the state, having taken from Milwaukee County the responsibility to decide certification questions, issued Ms. Humphreys her certificate. That mooted the claim for injunctive relief. The claim for damages then was decided by the district court on the qualified immunity defense on the defense's motion for summary judgment. That is the issue that is up here today. The question of the qualified immunity defense of the individual defendants in the damages suit. Because of the summary judgment posture, I want to take a few minutes to distinguish what are undisputed facts from what either are not facts at all or are disputed. And I want to do that in five areas. First, about the 1988 documents that have been called the substantiated finding. Second, about the October 2008 decision to deny Ms. Humphreys her certification that is embodied in Mr. Munoz's letter of October 2008. Third, the February 2009 decision of hearing examiner Partapillo. Fourth, the April 1, 2009, from these defendants, from Pang, and I have spoken with opposing counsel. We shall refer to the person who is identified as Zhang in the briefs by the name she prefers, Pang. She is the defendant, one of the defendants. Her letter to a state employee requests that a notification be issued, and there is no evidence that was ever issued. And the fifth fact I want to talk about is the June 2000 letter from Mary Kennedy, a state employee, that determines that the 1988 documents do not even rise to the level of a substantiated
finding. So before you get into that, though, see, my bottom line is the cases you rely on as to whether qualified immunity applies are all distinguishable from our situation because the defendants here were not child abuse investigators. They didn't make that initial finding, and that's an important distinction. We're in a whole different situation here.
Two reasons.
Because there was another agency that made that finding.
It is a difference, Your Honor, but it is not a distinction. And here's the response. Number one, Doyle is not limited to investigators. The defendants in Doyle involve investigators, investigator supervisors, the people who determine that that information will be put into the stream of information entered into the database, the officials in the department who approved the evidence policy.
Right, that's
those
all still
all
within
defendants.
One agency. That's all within one agency.
It does not have to be within the one agency, however. Those functions could have been distributed among multiple agencies. Those defendants happen to be employed by the same agency. The point is there is a liberty interest, and different people may violate the Constitution in different parts of the process. For example, in Doyle, Ms. Everett Williams is not involved in what's called the credible evidence issue. Ms. Everett Williams is involved in the notice issue.
Look, although there's no question that it's clearly established that person is entitled to hearing rights before a substantiated finding of abuse can be made. What I need to know is what case law establishes that persons who are not responsible for making such abuse determinations can't later rely on those determinations without independently, you know, assuring themselves that the finding was made pursuant to such a hearing. Because under your theory, you could sue a public school principal who refused to hire an applicant based on a substantiated finding of abuse because the principal didn't independently determine whether that finding was made pursuant to a proper hearing.
No, that's not my argument, Your Honor, and I want to clarify it. I am not saying that these defendants are liable for relying on the finding. I am not saying these defendants are liable for relying on the finding.
So what are
relying
you saying?
On
I thought
the
you
finding?
Were saying. I'm confused because
okay.
I thought that was the whole point.
No.
That they shouldn't have relied on it, and
they
like
are,
the defendants say, they had to rely on it. They can't independently do it, as my sister Judge Rovner says. And so I'm worried about where's the clearly established. You know, what's been clearly established that
they are entitled to make a mistake, and they made a mistake. My client
and the mistake
is entitled.
The mistake was relying on the unsubstantiated report.
Correct. They are entitled to make that mistake. Their violation of the due process clause is that they did not allow my client to be heard that they had made the mistake. I am entitled to come in and say, you who decided the substantiated finding is a determination made under 48.981 sub 3 sub A, you who have made that determination made an error.
Well, didn't she get a post-deprivation evidentiary hearing and she won?
She did. And these defendants then did not issue the certificate. They continued the deprivation.
Well, but the defendants couldn't reverse the abuse finding. Only BMCW could do that, right?
If that is their position, and I disagree with it.
Well, how could they reverse it? They don't have any authority. They don't have any jurisdiction. They don't have any power.
I am not asking them to reverse it. I am asking them to make a determination that a substantiated finding.
Of course you're asking
no,
them to reverse
Your Honor,
it.
I'm not, and here's the distinction. I am not asking them to say this is not a substantiated finding of abuse. It is a substantiated finding of abuse that until it gets reversed in 2010, it is a substantiated finding of abuse. I am saying my client is entitled to make the following argument. A substantiated finding of abuse in 1988 is not a determination made under 48.981(3)(a)(4). I am entitled to make that argument. Yes, it is a substantiated finding of abuse, but that, having been made in 1988, is not a ground by which you may, under the statute, deny the certification. I am entitled to be heard on that issue.
Well, you know, you argue that the failure to comply with the hearing examiner's adjudication violated procedural due process. And I've been trying to figure out how that's a due process violation at all when procedures such as mandamus were available to compel compliance and were not taken advantage of.
I already had mandamus relief, Your Honor. I had an order, a final order, from an administrative hearing examiner that said, process the application. Reinstate her to the application process at the point at which you disrupted it.
You know where...
That is mandamus relief, Your Honor.
Where my real problem comes in here. And I hope I... At one point, the brief appears to argue that she's not contending that the defendants had to provide a pre-deprivation hearing before making that determination. In other locations in the brief, it appears that what's being argued is that the defendants could not rely on that substantiated claim at all unless such a hearing was given.
If I have been...
So I really felt whipsawed, to be honest.
Okay. If I have been unclear, let me clarify it now. I believe that the trilogy establishes the following process is due when a liberty interest or a property interest is implicated. A credible evidence standard, which isn't an issue here, and a pre-deprivation administrative conference. If I have been inartful in referring to that as a pre-deprivation hearing, then I have been inartful and I apologize. Dupuis says the process requires some pre-deprivation opportunity to be heard, followed then by a prompt post-deprivation hearing. That's the process due. That's the process that is clearly established. And my claim is that my client's rights have been violated because she never was given the opportunity to say, you are wrong in equating a 1988 substantiated finding with the statutory criterion, a determination made under 948.981(3)(c). Let me illustrate it with this example. If I apply for a driver's license and the driver's license examiner tells me your license is denied until you go chase a goose around the parking lot.
No, until you go back to the officer in another county that gave you a ticket.
Pardon?
Your analogy is interesting because if the license is revoked or something, it's because somebody else made a decision.
No, but I am denied by this clerk who is telling me the statutory requirement requires that you go chase a goose. And I am saying the Constitution... The Constitution entitles me to a prompt hearing on whether or not you can condition my license on chasing a goose. I could go chase the goose.
I don't understand the chasing the goose.
Okay. The statutory criterion.
That's okay.
I understand. The statutory criterion under which she was denied her certification was in error. And we are entitled to argue, to be heard on the argument that you denied me on a ground that is not permitted by the statute. Even if the 1988 events do constitute a substantiated finding of abuse.
The first time she got approval, that didn't bother with that 88 thing, did they?
She didn't have the liberty interest because nobody had found it. That's right. She was not entitled to a hearing at that time.
Well, maybe somebody considered that obsolete and the next person didn't know anything.
The record doesn't indicate that. She did not have an entitlement, a protected interest, until these defendants acted. And these defendants made the conclusion, which we argue is erroneous, but the constitutional issue is that we are entitled to be heard on it, that the substantiated finding of abuse from 1988 is not the statutory criterion by which they may deny the certification. We never got that hearing. We never got an opportunity to be heard on that because these defendants in the post-hearing deprivation, after we won our hearing, never gave us the error-correcting procedure to challenge their claim. That's the due process violation.
They don't have to do that.
They have
I have seen no precedent for such a determination, at least none provided here. What you're arguing, basically it seems to me that do you have any case law that would require a hearing concerning the procedures used in abuse determinations before others can rely on them? Because I think that's what this whole thing comes down to.
I am not arguing that. No, Your Honor, I am arguing that the determination the substantiated finding is not a determination made under 48.9813C. And that is the difference. Not all substantiated findings are determinations made under 48.983. And that's the argument that I am entitled to make and would not allowed to make.
Okay. Hurry up here, Mr. Knott, and help us to understand.
I shall rush. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court.
Right.
Counsel, my name is Doug Knott. I represent the appellees who are two employees of Milwaukee County. They are Juan Munez and Pang Jiang. I compliment Mr. Myers. He is clearly a knowledgeable attorney and an energetic advocate for his clients. Obviously, we disagree with his position, as did the district court. I'd like to take this opportunity with this court to discuss what I believe to be the fundamental points of disagreement underlying this litigation. One is whether Ms. Humphreys has met her burden of demonstrating that the law was clearly established in 2008 that my client's conduct was unconstitutional and that my clients should have been aware of such. Mr. Myers has cited here the same cases cited in the court below, and the court below made a distinction. The second point I'd like to discuss...
What's your bottom line on that? Let's get your bottom line. The bottom line is what? Your bottom line is that it was a different agency. They shouldn't be held accountable. Why don't you address his big, because he's saying, those cases really are distinguishable, and he keeps citing this one reg with all the little different parts to it. I don't see why that's, you need to speak to that.
Absolutely, Your Honor. We feel that the distinction that the district court made and the distinction that Your Honor made in her questioning is absolutely the appropriate one. The trilogy, unlike the officials in the trilogy of cases, my clients, Muniz and Pang, were not investigating the abuse. They did not put the findings of the abuse into a registry where it could be seen. And why is that a significant distinction? It's because my clients did not have the power to direct the investigation, to steer, to determine what standard is applied, what notice is given before the finding is made in 1988. They did not have that power. And most importantly, they were not employed by the agency that had that power. Mr. Meyer argues that they are like the supervisors in the trilogy, that he cited Ms. Williams in Dupuy. Ms. Williams was a supervisor of the investigators, and it was found that she had violated the applicant's rights because she endorsed what happened, what the investigators did. The distinction to make is that my clients are not supervisors of the investigators. They were not employed by the agency that maintained the registry. And the second key distinction is that my clients had no discretion under the Wisconsin law to ignore the 1988 finding. The investigators in the trilogy of cases were not compelled by law to find abuse. They were not compelled by law to put the finding of abuse in a registry. But here, Pang and Muniz were required as background checkers in Milwaukee County to take guidance from the state of Wisconsin. In fact, they took that guidance from the state of Wisconsin. The record demonstrates that they called the state and said, what do we do with this situation? And the state said, you must deny. As long as this finding is in our file, you cannot issue a certification. At that point, my clients issued a letter to the state with a copy to Mr. Meyer's partner asking the state to issue additional hearing rights so that that finding could be removed from that file. For whatever reason, Mr. Myers and Ms. Humphreys did not ask for that hearing, and the state did not schedule it, but the state is not sued.
No, Mike, what would have been the process if they followed suit with that letter?
If they followed
suit, where do they go then to get the process?
They go to an agency that's called, of the state of Wisconsin, that's called the Bureau of Milwaukee Child Care. That is not a Milwaukee County agency. It's a state of Wisconsin agency. It is the agency that maintains the child abuse and neglect registry. And that agency has established protocols for a for notice and a hearing in a trial-type setting.
Is that the only place they could go to get that, we'll call it erased, or to vacate or whatever eventually happened?
Yes, because the Bureau is the holder of that file. They are the maintainers of that registry. That finding cannot be removed by anyone other than the Bureau.
And Muniz and
there
Pang,
are multiple processes. Excuse me.
Muniz and Pang, is that part of their duty, is to check that particular, database, or what do you call the?
Absolutely.
That's what they do? They check that?
It's referred to as a database.
And they're obligated to follow it?
That's right, Your Honor. When the process started with Ms. Humphreys submitting an application for recertification, that landed on Mr. Muniz's desk. He contacts the state because he doesn't even have access to the registry. He contacts the state and asks them to report, to let us know what findings you can find, what findings are out there for Ms. Humphreys. For some reason, they didn't report on two prior applications,
right,
the finding of abuse. In 2008, they did. Now, Mr. Muniz had no discretion under Wisconsin law, as interpreted by the state of Wisconsin and his own superiors. He had no discretion to ignore that. So the trilogy of, and Mr. Meyer has a clever interpretation, an ingenious interpretation. He says that we applied the label and we gave it consequence in 2008, and that's somehow different than what happened in the trilogy. That's not really the case. The label was there. That's what distinguishes that circumstance. The label was there in a file that we had neither the ability to remove or to question. And we were the persons who read the label. Seeing that label, we had no choice under Wisconsin law but to deny the certification. Mr. Myers has and Ms. Humphreys have failed in their to meet their burden of demonstrating clearly established law that these old findings must be dealt in some way by my clients. He has not cited a case, and nor does the trilogy of cases address what to do when a state statute gives the local official no discretion but to follow the law. And most importantly, he has not cited a case that addresses someone other than the initial investigator and the agency that enters the finding.
How complicated is that process if they would follow the letter from Muniz of what to do about it? Getting a hearing and whatever. It seems that would have been a good thing to do, but is that expensive or is it complicated? Maybe she didn't want to do.
She was successful in it when she chose to pursue it. Again, I don't know why she didn't pursue it.
No, I understand there was she doing some other kind of care or whatever that didn't require that certification. I'm not quite sure. Did she have some other child care job?
Our position is that her career was not substantially interrupted.
Because
her
she was doing something else.
She was in the child care industry. Her certificate expired on August 21, 2008. She testified in deposition that she was working for a child care agency on September 3rd of 2008. There was not a significant disruption in her career, which is also a distinguishing fact from the trilogy. In the trilogy of cases, the Illinois law is a blacklist. You can't work in the industry if you're on that list. In this case, the certification is for receipt of a subsidy.
Something to do with the government.
If there's
a government subsidy involved, then you got to have this. If you're working for some private agency, it's not required, I guess. Certification.
I think that what is required is that you have clients who qualify for what's called, I think, a Wisconsin Shares program, and that subsidizes the child care. But it is a private, and it can be at a private agency, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Myers has really has articulated this argument on qualified immunity to try to bring himself within the trilogy by making the stigma plus argument and the argument today about the goose and the driver's license. I'm not going to get back into the goose and the driver's license, but I will say that in terms of this court's analysis of the issue before it, the question is whether there was clearly established law that told my clients that what they were doing was unconstitutional. There's no clearly established law that says that a driver's office clerk can't send someone into to chase a goose. That's obvious. But what Mr. Myers cannot cite is a case that addresses, I apologize for getting into the driver's license, Mr. Myers cannot cite a case that that directs my clients to ignore old findings and ignore the Wisconsin statute.
Or any of the this was what was the year when this designation became obsolete or whatever, 2000 or something like that? There's that some overriding thing about process, but in 1988 that process didn't exist.
That's true. In 1988, the substantiated finding concerning Ms. Humphreys was made. The new law came into place in 1998. In October of 1998.
98, okay.
Yes. And in 1998, then additional procedural rights were granted.
Did it in any way render what was done before that obsolete, or did something more required that from people like that relied on it, like Muniz? That's what I'm wondering is there's implication in their brief, at least, that they should have known that this was pre-98 and should have been either looked into further or disregarded.
The 1998 law gave no guidance to background checkers as to what they should do in the circumstance of pre-1998 findings of abuse. There was a recognition in the manual that there may be problems with old findings, but it gave no direction to them to provide certain process. And I think that Mr. Meyer has spouted off the statutes in an impressive way. He says that that my clients erred. The argument he makes here today is that my clients erred in interpreting the 1988 substantiated finding as a quote determination, as that statute is set forth in 48.685.4M. I just want to say, as Mr. Myers presents the question, it is even more esoteric and complex than it was at the trial court level. And even more, and I think rather than taking him closer to meeting his burden of showing clearly established law, this esoteric and complicated question as he presents it now takes his client further from showing that the law was clearly established. He is presenting a more complex and difficult interpretation of statutory law than was actually argued in the trial court. The key to this, and one of the things I want to impress, is that Ms. Humphreys, it's our position.
You may have answered this, and it may have gone over my head, but did the defendants have actual notice that the substantiated findings from, you know, the original time period were made without due process protections?
No. No. I think reviewing the decision that was made, it refers to interviews with witnesses, including the claimant. There was no case law, and there was not actual notice of a decision made without a due process. As I said, there was no indication in the new law, the new statutes, or in any subsequent case law that those findings had to be ignored or that new process had to be availed. The court has is aware of the process that was eventually successful. And it is our position that Ms. Humphreys cannot proceed in this procedural due process claim, having not utilized the process that was offered to her. After the conference review in the Milwaukee agency, it was determined by the superiors in consultation with the Wisconsin Bureau that Ms. Humphreys needs to go to Madison in order to have this finding removed from her file. In the appendix to the plaintiff's record, page 24, on April 1, 2009, the defendant, Ms. Pang, wrote to the state of Wisconsin and said, please issue due process and we believe that due process and fundamental fairness requires that Shante Humphreys have an opportunity to appeal the basis. Please issue those rights. We believe that Ms. Humphreys failed to avail herself of process that was available under state law, and she cannot proceed. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Hey, Mr.
Meyer. Well, we're going to give him a couple of minutes.
I believe I should take it as a compliment that I am very esoteric. The constitutional issue, however, is not esoteric. The constitutional issue is this simple. When a protected liberty or a protected property interest is implicated, then those who deprive of protected liberty or protected property must provide some kind of hearing.
So they just couldn't rely on what was in the...
Those who do the deprivation must provide some kind of hearing.
They would say those who apply the law, because the law says they have to look at that.
And that's fine. If they felt compelled that they must deny, then their duty was to deny. And when they denied, if these defendants had denied, then I would have had a process esoteric argument.
Didn't that letter say the process?
No.
What did it say?
The letter says, state, you issue the notice that would then give her the right to challenge the 1988 decisions, and there is nothing in this record that the state ever gave that notice. Nothing that the state ever gave.
Who's to blame for that?
Pardon?
Who's to blame for that?
No one is to blame, because my esoteric argument is correct. Had the state does not agree that a 1988 substantiated finding is a determination under 48.981. The state disagrees with that. The state disagrees with that. And therefore, the state was under no obligation to respond to the April 1, 2009 letter. The duty of these defendants, when they deprived my client of property, was to deny the certification, which would have given me an error-correcting procedure. And they never did that.
Did they pass the buck?
Passed the buck.
Okay, I'm trying to guess. I'm not going to follow that goose that you were talking about. But
okay.
I'm trying to figure out what's...
Okay, the goose they want me to chase is to run find a hearing mechanism in the state that does not exist. That's the goose. They want me to chase that, and the state doesn't say, we will give you that hearing. Had the state given me the notice that says, we make a determination under 48.981(3)(a) that your client has committed abuse, we make that determination, I would have had a process. But the state never did that. The process I have is the process to challenge the denial of the certification. And that process, that error-correcting process, is only triggered if they deny. And they didn't deny. And that's the violation of the Constitution.
Are you suing them then because they passed the buck?
I'm suing them because they did not give me a prompt post-deprivation hearing that the trilogy says I am entitled to. Whatever the property interest, whatever the liberty interest.
She didn't get the certification.
Pardon?
She didn't get the certification, right?
She eventually got the certification.
Well, I mean with Muniz and Peng.
Correct. They never made a decision.
What happened? They just said maybe or what? What happened that it wasn't a denial?
These two defendants, we're done. Go chase a goose.
Okay.
That's what they said.
He will, I'm afraid.
Okay, that it is a simple due process issue. We were entitled to raise our esoteric argument at a due process hearing, and we never got the opportunity to make that argument. That's the simple due process violation.
Thanks very much.